I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring, welcoming you to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. What will it take to transform U.S. agriculture from climate problem to climate solution? We talked with farmers and others around the country working on this question, and it's going to take us two episodes to share what we learned. Here's part one, pay dirt.
I grew up on a farm. Both of my grandparents farmed. I've been involved with agriculture for my entire life.
That's Chris Prevatt. Chris and his wife and parents run two farms, one in Furman, Alabama, southwest of Montgomery, and another in Stark, Florida, just northeast of Gainesville.
Chris raises cattle and crops for his animals to eat.
We have 50 cow-calf pairs and about 300 head of stocker cattle. We graze 365 days a year.
Starting out, he farmed the same way as his parents and grandparents. But 5 years ago, he started making some big changes. He stopped plowing his fields, started planting a wider variety of crops, so there's something growing in his pastures year-round, and began moving his grazing stock to a new pasture every day.
Chris is practicing regenerative farming, a radical departure from the large-scale industrialized production of single crops and corn-soy rotations, which are losing topsoil 10 times faster than it can be replaced. Designed to improve soil health and fertility, regenerative farming protects soil by reducing or eliminating tillage and keeping it covered at all times with a diverse variety of crops. It introduces animals into crop operations and vice versa, and relies on the resulting manure and compost instead of synthetic fertilizer.
With two farms run by just four people, all that sounds like a lot more work. I asked Chris what he does in a typical day.
Checking the fence, moving cattle, build temporary grazing fence to get them moved. We're planting something 9 out of 12 months a year. It's a lot of work.
He says the benefits are already clear.
Here's how Chris described his soil before.
Very crusted, heavy clay soils. That won't allow water infiltration.
When it rained, water pooled in his fields.
Now, it's very soft. You can grab you a handful. It's more stable. It's healthier. It doesn't require the same amount of inputs. Water infiltration has been absolutely key. It's a healthy, functioning soil system. I don't have the same soil I had 8-10 years ago.
That healthy soil makes Chris's ranch more resilient to climate change.
I agree with a lot of the other ranchers that are out there. It seems like we get a little bit more heavy rainfalls, but they're not as often. We may go 30, 45 days without a rain, and everyone's invested in all this irrigation equipment. I feel like we can get focused on improving the soil health and be able to grow a lot of crops without irrigation just by improving the soil.
Chris's crops no longer require synthetic fertilizers or chemicals, which were formerly a big expense.
No herbicides, no fungicides, no insecticides.
Instead of killing cover crops with herbicides and then planting Roundup Ready seeds, he just lets in the cows.
We're grazing and then planting right behind it.
With the year-round variety and abundance of forage, Chris no longer needs to buy hay or feed supplements.
There's plenty of grasses out there, but there's so many legumes, forbs, broadleafs, brassicas. There's so many things out there for them to pick through and select for. At the end of the day, they're better at selecting what their diet is than any nutritionist that's going to make a ration for them.
You sound more like a farmer than a rancher.
Yeah, plants are our system. The cattle, just providing them with fresh plants, they take care of themselves. They're going to be fat and happy out there in the pasture. They don't need anything in addition.
You know, when you talk about what your cows eat, you sound like a gourmet chef at a restaurant.
I probably didn't have that 10 years ago, but today is because you can see the behavior differences in cattle. They love moving. They love moving to the next paddock. It's like they're moved to a new buffet every day, and there's a day's worth of eating at that buffet.
Regenerative farming does something more.
Just on our small farm, 600 acres, we're storing enough carbon in our soil for about 850 flights from LAX to JFK.
Where did this carbon come from, and how does it get into the soil?
When plants photosynthesize, they take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, add a little sunlight, and voila, it turns into sugar. Well, that's the Cliff Notes version anyway. Plants use this carbon-rich sugar as currency in an underground trading system, exchanging it with fungi for other valuable nutrients. And that's one way the carbon gets into the soil. Another is when microbes break down plant residues that are left in the field, like cover crops. Regenerative methods leave all these busy microbes undisturbed to do their jobs. If you give them enough to eat, don't plow up their homes or spray them with toxic chemicals, you get more carbon in your soil.
Jeff Creek, a carbon farming pioneer in California, is one of the reasons we know that this really works.
I came to carbon farming out of a 25-year history of farming organically. I was really blessed to have that opportunity for 25 years to farm that piece of land, which had been horribly abused historically, really beaten to hell. You know, in the process of trying to farm, produce organic produce and cut flowers, milk and honey, and do all that while restoring that degraded watershed was a real education.
As the land responded to his restoration efforts, Jeff saw the results in his soil, and he and some other farmers got the idea that maybe they could sell carbon credits.
That took us on a journey to UC Berkeley. A biogeochemist by the name of Dr. Wendy Silver started working with us.
They did an experiment.
We simply put half an inch of compost out onto grazed grassland in Marin County, and we replicated this work up in the Sierra foothills at the UC Experiment Station at Browns Valley. And then we came back about 6 months later, and sure enough, we were able to measure a change in soil carbon in response to that compost application. We also saw a very significant increase in forage production, an increase in soil water holding capacity. None of that should be too surprising to anybody who's worked with compost. However, what was stunning, really, none of us had really anticipated, was that the extra carbon we were measuring in the system was additional above and beyond the compost itself. In other words, the compost had induced an increase in the photosynthetic capture of carbon. That was kind of an earth-shattering discovery.
Increasing soil carbon on farms and grazing land has tremendous potential as a climate solution. Even if it only increased by 1% to 2%, multiply that small number by the 250 million acres of cropland and 770 million acres of rangeland in the U.S. alone, you wind up with a big number.
According to the National Academy of Science, U.S. agricultural soil has the potential to remove 250 million metric tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere every year. Jeff calls managing farms to increase soil carbon, carbon farming. But isn't it just the same as organic farming? And why pay farmers extra to do it when we already pay a premium for organic products? Organic, sustainable, regenerative, what's the difference?
All of those terms have kind of a nebulous definition. For me, organic farming was always about soil carbon. But as organic farming became more mainstream, the focus on soil organic matter has been, if not lost, at least highly diluted. And I've seen practices on organic farms that I would not consider to be climate beneficial in any way, shape, or form. So there's not a perfect fit there. Sustainability, of course, is a very subjective term and has been widely abused. What I like about carbon farming is it's very clean. It's very simple. We know exactly what we're talking about when we talk about increasing the carbon content of our working landscapes. There's nothing nebulous about it.
Now Jeff helps other farmers create carbon plans for their farms as part of his work at the Carbon Cycle Institute.
It's always a bit of a challenge to step into a vineyard, for example, where people have been tilling for decades, and you suggest that, well, maybe we could go to alternate row tillage, or maybe we could just cold turkey stop tilling and start mowing instead, or maybe bring some sheep in that deal with that overgrowth in the spring. There are a lot of different avenues, and I think that the real challenge and the opportunity with carbon farming is to get the farmer thinking about the flow of carbon into and through their farm system, because ultimately everything they produce on that farm is completely dependent on the capture of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And once they understand that, it can totally transform the way they think about what they're doing. And I've seen that happen enough times now to know that it does happen, and it's pretty amazing to see. Another example, a wool producer up in northeastern California, is a producer of some of the best wool in California, who was extremely skeptical, I would almost say overtly hostile to even the concept of climate change, and yet saw the opportunity to get a premium for the wool they were producing through an agreement with North Face to see if we could develop a carbon farm plan that would actually result in carbon beneficial wool production. And we had no idea going in what we could achieve, but we discovered that there was the opportunity to offset greenhouse gases associated with their wool production by several times. And that producer is now getting a premium for her wool that is driving implementation of practices to capture more carbon on farm. That, I would say, was an amazing success story and a real transformation in how that producer perceived themselves and their product and really their place in the world.
Let's talk about animals for a minute. Most of what we hear about climate and farm animals is that cow burps produce methane.
Increasing soil carbon in grazing land can help counteract that.
There's also some good evidence out there that soils are net methane sinks.
A sink in climate lingo is the opposite of a source. A certain widespread bacteria in soil literally sucks methane out of the atmosphere. They're the only things on the planet who can do that.
Well-managed pasture systems are probably net sinks for carbon. That could change under a more intensive system like a dairy, for example. But I'm pretty confident that we can actually have carbon negative or climate beneficial dairy production if we really put our minds to it.
Cheese lovers, rejoice!
It would be great if every farmer would adopt regenerative practices. But while regenerative farmers break even or do even better than conventional farmers over time because they don't need to buy expensive farm chemicals, there is still an upfront price of admission for things like seeds and machinery.
We can talk about how great no-till is, but a no-till drill is extremely expensive. I didn't want to drop $50,000, $75,000. I was just like, dang, this is going to take a lot to really jump in and do this.
In the end, Chris had to sell off some of his old farming equipment, which meant there was no turning back.
You have to give up your old ways of doing things. You got to completely, you know, jump off that wagon. You can't go halfway.
Not everyone is willing to take that kind of risk. So where's the money going to come from? What about those carbon credits that Jeff and his buddies wanted to sell?
You mean carbon offsets, like when you buy a plane ticket and pay to support a project somewhere that eliminates the amount of greenhouse gases produced by your flight. Companies do that on a larger scale, either to meet sustainability goals or comply with regulations. Until recently, these carbon offset markets were not very friendly to farmers.
Alden Donnelly is the director of carbon economics at a Seattle startup that is setting out to change that.
She says nature-based carbon removal can't compete in markets designed to decrease carbon pollution.
The proof that you did it for projects that remove CO2 from the atmosphere are way, way, way more stringent than the tests they apply to approve emission reduction projects.
And what farmers can get paid is way, way, way below their cost. Alden says that's because many carbon offsets aren't backed by actual cuts in emissions, or at least not as much as advertised.
The performance standard baseline says in the industry you're in, the 30% cleanest plants discharge so many tons CO2 equivalent per unit of output. Anybody who does better than that performance baseline can sell credits, giving a whole bunch of industry and electricity producers the right to sell credits that don't have any underlying environmental value.
I'm going to say that again. The companies that are already in the top 30%, because somebody has to be, get to sell credits without doing anything.
What does that mean? It means that these markets end up being overwhelmed and flooded with what looks like a whole bunch of extra certificates when you compare what's being traded to the physical inventories we're trying to change.
All those credits for doing nothing lower the price farmers can get for doing something and decreases the likelihood that they'll ever get paid in the first place.
The operators of those markets generate more than 80% of their revenues by charging the project owners, the farmers, and the forest managers fees. And to date, going back to 2003, more than 40% of all of the offset credits that have ever been listed for sale have never been bought by anybody. So in those markets, it's 40% likely that after a number of years of paying pretty substantial project listing fees, you still won't have earned a penny of revenue from offset credit sales.
I found Alden's carbon economic lesson pretty discouraging.
For an individual farmer, the costs are high and the reward is uncertain.
But her company, Nori, has a solution.
We're creating a separate, distinct market that focuses only on drawdown and retention of carbon into natural systems so that we can get the accounting right from the get-go.
Murray's solution uses modeling to lower the burden of proof for individual farmers.
The team at Colorado State University built a model to allow farmers to, for free, go in and hypothesize changes in practices. You put a whole bunch of data into their model and then say to yourself, now, if I changed this crop rotation in this field over here, or if I added cover crops, or if I changed my tillage practices, what would be the impact over the next 10 years on my soil organic carbon stocks and my greenhouse gas emissions and my energy use? We're using that model and saying to farmers, use this tool to consider changes. And if and when you make changes, we'll issue you a carbon removal ton and you can sell it.
So this year, if someone's been very, very bad and you want to put a hypothetical lump of coal in their Christmas stocking, or if you just want to do something very, very good, you can go to nori.com and buy some carbon removal from a farmer for $15 a ton. And if you're a farmer wondering how to increase organic carbon in your soil, you can find out with no obligation at comet-farm.com. Indigo Ag is another company trying to turn soil carbon into cash.
They are staying in the regular market, but act as a middleman, paying farmers to adopt regenerative practices and selling the resulting carbon credits themselves.
Ed Smith is the director of Indigo's carbon division. Here's what I call his grain elevator pitch to farmers.
You can have a second cash crop the exact same time as your current cash crop. You can be farming carbon. And at the same time, you are increasing the resilience and longevity of your farm. And if that wasn't enough, the last cherry on top is the regenerative growers that we work with all cite that their costs go down after transitioning to regenerative practices.
Indigo is initially paying farmers to adopt one or more of five practices.
Reduced tillage, cover crops, reduced synthetic inputs, livestock integration, and more diverse crop rotation. So that's the starting five. Less than 1% of growers out there have adopted all the practices to the maximum extent possible. And so that means 99% of growers in the US can do something. Even if you're already no-till, would love to see you plant a cover crop. Even if you're planting a cover crop, maybe it's a single species cover crop, would love to see you go to a multi-species cover crop. We will meet any grower wherever they are.
Like Nori, Indigo uses computer modeling to predict what each practice will do.
Based on the data we pull off the farm, it spits out carbon changes as well as methane, nitrous oxide emissions. So it's actually more than just soil carbon.
Nitrous oxide, which comes from fertilizer, has a global warming power 300 times greater than carbon dioxide. Since Indigo aggregates and sells credits from multiple farms, they don't have to test the soil in every single field.
Basically, it's like polling. You don't have to ask every voter in Iowa to get a sense of where that state is trending. And so we will soil sample a representative population of fields to make sure that the modeling is accurate.
Indigo currently pays farmers $15 per ton of carbon, but the payment is spread out over 10 years.
Let's say you're a farmer. In 2020, you sequester carbon and I can sell that carbon for $20 a ton. Indigo takes a cut, which is $5. You'll get $15 a ton for all the carbon you sequestered in 2020, but we pay you over time. So you'll get $1.50 a year for 10 years.
In Indigo's first year, 2020, they contracted with 800 farms.
They adopted one or more regenerative practices on over 1 million acres. And a number of big corporations promised to buy all the resulting carbon credits.
Farmers as the heroes in climate change is a story that consumers and companies absolutely love.
Problem solved, right? But here are some things to consider. Some of the corporations buying those credits have done a good job lowering their own greenhouse gas emissions. The hands of others are not so clean.
Like covered in oil and coal dust, one is J.P. Morgan, the biggest financer of fossil fuel extraction in the world, and another, Barclays, is the biggest funder of fossil fuel infrastructure in Europe.
And some of the investors in these new carbon markets are big ag companies like Archer Daniels Midland, Syngenta, and Cargill, who lobby heavily to continue farm policies that are most responsible for greenhouse gas emissions. Even when carbon credit buyers aren't using them for greenwashing, there's a justice issue. Polluting industries buy offsets in rural areas so they can keep on polluting in their own neighborhoods, which are often low-income communities of color. Jim Goodman, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, thinks offsets are the wrong tool for the job.
That's kind of a bass-ackwards way of going about it, because the best you could achieve would be shifting carbon from one place to another. The polluting industries can keep polluting as long as they can find enough people to offset the pollution they're making. Big industries shouldn't continue to count on farmers to do that.
And there's another thing. The average size of farms enrolled in Indigo Carbon is around 9,000 acres. Jeff Creek doesn't see carbon credits as helpful for the farms he works with.
They may offer some opportunity for very, very large producers of commodity crops in the Midwest, where the guy can say, well, you know, it's only $15 an acre, but I've got 25,000 acres of wheat, and it's not going to cost me that much. But is that the kind of agriculture we want to be supporting with this stuff? It's not going to pay off for small producers who have to take a lot of risk for very little return.
Just to take the devil's advocate position, if most of the farmland is held by these big corporations, programs that focus on them will have the biggest impact.
True. But if there are unforeseen consequences, that big impact could go in either direction. Jim worries that giving large farms yet another economic advantage could drive more smaller farms out of business.
Over history, we've seen smaller farms being pushed out in favor of bigger ones. There's every reason to believe that a scheme like this would do the same thing. When you commodify carbon, you're really kind of narrowing the scope of what good farming practices are. Narrow solutions like that seldom work as they're intended, and they're not good for the big picture of the way farming needs to change.
Relying on a carbon market also leaves the price to be set by supply and demand, instead of its cost to farmers or value to society.
You have to put a price on carbon that reflects the real costs of doing the work, get it out of the atmosphere. You know, when we look at technological solutions, direct air capture, people are talking upwards of $200 a ton, sometimes $600 a ton, but we're only going to pay farmers $15 a ton to do it on the land. There's something terribly amiss. Any objective evaluation of our situation right now from the global climate perspective would say that's worth a lot.
Finally, there's a lot we still don't know about soil carbon. For example, soil samples to a depth of 1 foot show that regenerative practices increase soil carbon. But as scientists start taking deeper samples down to 3 feet, they're finding that the lower levels have reduced carbon. So is there really a net gain?
And there's the issue of permanence. Soil carbon is easily lost if a farmer goes back to tilling or from climate impacts like drought and increased temperatures. Stephen Woods, soil ecologist and senior scientist for soil and food systems at the Nature Conservancy, is among those who have doubts about agricultural carbon markets being ready for prime time.
It's so early in the game. They've made some pretty broad statements about what they see as the size of the prize and the potential. Once we see if they can achieve that, I think it'll be a lot clearer. You know, there is so much discussion about the state of the science. Can we build soil carbon? Can we get enough adoption of these practices at scale to get the benefits that we're looking for? That has become largely a kind of armchair debate amongst people who are smart, well-intentioned scientists. What is needed is to go out and try to do this. Start to pay farmers and see what happens. I think part of the reason why you have organizations like Indigo stepping in is that they feel like that hasn't happened and that they're looking to disrupt this space.
The folks at Nori and Indigo are jump-starting the process to get answers to these unresolved questions.
Indigo, for example, will be taking more of those 3-foot soil samples.
They'll be sharing what they learn with researchers.
We will not share data that would reveal the identity of a grower, but you can aggregate and anonymize data in a way that would still be very useful for scientific purposes, but not risk growers' privacy.
Those who are working on the ground with farmers say money alone won't be enough. Farmers need technical support and communities of practice in order to make the transition. We don't currently have that, but Jeff points out that we do have a great example in the government's response to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s.
At that time, of course, we had a functional federal government, and the response was highly articulate. The idea was to put in place a whole network of technical service providers and technical expertise to support agriculture in adopting soil conservation practices, which today we could just as easily call climate beneficial practices. It was recognized that edicts coming down from the federal government weren't going to be very popular at the local level. Conservation districts at the county level were intended to be managed by local agricultural producers themselves. These districts exist in almost every county in the country.
The local part is important because conditions vary from region to region, farm to farm, and even from field to field.
It's not as simple as saying do this or that and everything will be fine. It does come down to very individualized prescription. Timing, duration of impacts, number of animals, how many acres. All of this is very, very site specific.
Unfortunately, federal support for soil conservation has eroded over the years.
There's limited technical service available. We've gutted our on-the-ground service providers. We have essentially pulled the rug out from under the structures that would, in fact, support this work on the ground.
I know you're thinking, what kind of a solution show is this? You put up a solution and shot it down. We can't change farming on a national scale without changing what our government subsidizes and invests in.
Government subsidies are forcing farmers to do the wrong things right now. So it's just a question of how do we get them to do the right thing? And there's really sort of two general ways of doing it. One, start doing the right thing in a corner of the marketplace and then going to government and saying, do you agree this looks good? This is working. And government says yes. And then you say to government, so if you introduce this policy, you could see that happening everywhere. How do you feel about that? I think that's a much more efficient way of getting government to abandon the policies that aren't working and consider policies that do than the alternative, which might be to go to government and say, let's set up a committee and talk for 5 years about what maybe theoretically the right way of doing things looks like.
I don't think Big Ag is going to just sit around and let their subsidies be redirected to regenerative farmers.
That's why you need to come back for part two about breaking up Big Ag and an agricultural Green New Deal. You've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up. Thanks to our guests, Chris Pravat, Jeff Creek, Alden Connolly, Ed Smith, Jim Goodman, and Stephen Woods, and to Scott Holmes, Josh Woodward, Dan Leibowitz, and Nat Keefe and the Bowties for our music.